Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. The show is brought to you by ChrisKresser.com. Now, Steve is off today on a meditation retreat, so I'm your guest host, Jordan Reisner from SCD Lifestyle. And with me is integrative medical practitioner, healthy skeptic, and New York Times bestselling author, Chris Kresser. Chris, welcome.
Jordan, happy you're here. And I'm happy Steve's off walking the talk, you know. It'll be interesting to hear about his experience when he gets back.
I'm excited. He'll be back tomorrow, so I'm looking forward to it.
And this was his first 10-day Vipassana, is that right?
Yeah, it's his first one.
Oh, so. Yeah. Should be really interesting to hear about.
Yeah, I love all of our friends are just like coming back from Burning Man, and Steve's coming back from the meditation retreat.
Yeah, so. Other side of the spectrum. Hopefully you haven't been getting any text messages from him in the last 10 days.
It's been radio silent.
Good.
So he's been a good boy.
All right, cool. Well, we have a good question.
Before we dive in, let's talk about your breakfast, because I know that we always get a lot of flack from the listeners if we don't ask about your breakfast, right?
Right, okay. So let's see. Had some chorizo from, we buy half a pig from a local rancher a couple times a year, and then a butcher in Santa Rosa, Willowside Meats, butchers it and gives us a whole bunch of different cuts. And one of the things they do is make this really amazing chorizo. So we had some of that, some scrambled eggs, some sauerkraut and beet kvass, and some plantains fried in expeller pressed coconut oil. That's pretty standard breakfast around here. It's a good one. Sylvie loves it. We all like it. It's pretty easy to make.
I love your breakfast because it always has like 5 to 7 parts to it.
Yeah. It's all about the diversity, right?
Yeah, exactly.
To just feed those gut bugs.
You grew up on Lucky Charms, and it's a nice transition, right?
Yeah, thankfully I didn't grow up on Lucky Charms. I always have, you know, as I get older, more and more appreciation for my parents and the way that my mom fed us when we were young. I mean, certainly she wasn't feeding us paleo. That wasn't really part of the understanding at that point, but she fed us really a pretty healthy diet overall. So I'm happy about that. We have a good question today from Seamus, I think it is. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but I think that's the right way. And let's give it a listen.
Hi, Chris. Just wanted to ask what would be the best way to deal with methanogens in people with SIBO. I know Dr. Siebiger says that it's best to use Allicin, but it seems that I have a negative response, extreme fatigue and things like that after taking it. So, thanks.
All right. So let's jump in here. This is a great question, and a lot of people might not be familiar with the term methanogen, but it is something that people should be aware of, and especially if you have SIBO or suspect you may have SIBO. And we've talked about SIBO a lot, so for people that are new to the show or new to this work, this is stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And it's defined as a pathological increase in bacteria in the small bowel. And as a reminder, we have a lot of bacteria in our gut. And in fact, the bacteria and other organisms in our gut outnumber human cells by 10 to 1. But the location of that bacteria is really important. It should mostly be in the colon, the large intestine. We do have small amounts of bacteria all the way through the digestive tract from the mouth to the anus, but the majority of the bacteria should be in the colon. And very little should be in the small intestine because the small intestine is where we digest and absorb food. And if you have a lot of bacteria growing in the small intestine, that's going to interfere with the assimilation of nutrients from food, which is one of the major effects, adverse effects of SIBO. So most of the research that you've probably heard about has focused on the role of bacteria in the gut, but recent evidence suggests that archaea also play a role. So that's A-R-C-H-E-A. And archaea are actually a completely different class of organism than bacteria. They're pretty ancient single-celled organisms with no cell nucleus and no membrane-bound organelles. And they were originally classified as bacteria, but they're now classified as prokaryotes, which, again, are a completely different class. They're considered totally unique from the other two major domains of life, which are bacteria and eukaryotes. And some of the archaea that you might have heard of, or you know, in the news, the mainstream media, are halophiles and thermophiles. So these are archaea that live in extreme environments like salt lakes or hot springs. But we now know that archaea are present in pretty much every habitat where you see biodegradation of organic compounds occurring. And that includes animal guts and human guts. So when you go to get a breath test for SIBO, which is one of the major ways of testing for SIBO that we talk about, they're going to measure the presence of and the production of methane and hydrogen gases at baseline. And then they're also going to measure the increase in hydrogen and methane production that occurs after you drink a sugary solution that they give you as part of the test procedure. So typically, if you have an increase in hydrogen, a significant increase in hydrogen or methane after drinking this sugary solution, it means you have an overgrowth of bacteria in your gut. But to be more specific, when you have an increase in methane after drinking this solution, or if you just have high levels of methane at baseline, that indicates an overgrowth not of bacteria, but of these methane-producing archaea. So unlike bacteria, which primarily produce hydrogen, the archaea are what produce this methane. And they do this actually not by fermenting carbohydrates. So bacteria produce hydrogen. The way they do that is by fermenting fibers. And the methane actually production works differently. The archaea consume the hydrogen that's produced by the hydrogen producing bacteria, and then they produce methane as a byproduct of that process. So this is actually one of the ways that excess hydrogen in the gut gets metabolized, is by these methanogenic archaea converting that hydrogen into methane. And another way that hydrogen gets dealt with is by bacteria that convert hydrogen into sulfides. That's probably a little more detail than you needed, but it's kind of interesting to see how this all works. So methane production begins at about 3 years of age. So you don't see any methane production in infants, for example. And this suggests that methane production has everything to do with how the gut is colonized initially, because there are no archaea initially in the gut. And it peaks at about 10 years of age when adult levels are reached. So by the time a child is 10, they're typically producing the adult amounts of methane that they would produce for their whole life. But here's the thing, not everybody produces methane. So depending on the studies that you look at, the numbers I've seen range from 30% to 50% of adults being methane producers. So anywhere from a third to a half of people have significant amounts of archaea that produce detectable amounts of methane. So that's something important to understand. This is not an issue that affects everybody. So what's the big deal about methane? This is Seamus's question, you know, is the presence of methane different? Does it require a different approach? And I think the answer is yes, from what we see in the research and then what I've seen in my clinical experience working with patients. Methane is a colorless, odorless, inert gas. And for a long time, it was thought that it didn't really have any impact on human health, except for maybe causing a little bit of bloating and distension if you had high levels of it. But more recent evidence actually has linked methane production to various disease states. And it's still somewhat unclear whether that's because of the level of methane itself or whether it's because of the removal of hydrogen from the bowel that happens when that hydrogen is converted to methane by archaea. But we do know from studies that methane-producing archaea are present in 45% of people with SIBO. So in other words, a substantial percentage of people with SIBO have methane-producing archaea. And the amount of methane that's produced is significantly higher in patients with SIBO compared with patients with fructose and lactose malabsorption, which are other gut issues. So if you're looking at a breath test, the presence of methane, if like to consider yourself a methane producer, you would have baseline methane levels of over 3 parts per million. And I can tell you from running a lot of these tests that that's quite common. It's more than 50%, I would say, in my patient population. But then again, I'm probably, you know, I'm testing people that mostly have SIBO and other gut issues. So it's not really necessarily a representative sample.
So now, Chris, if I'm a patient and I'm experiencing problems, I think it's SIBO, and I'm not looking at a test, are there symptoms that are different in somebody who's predominantly going to have methane-producing bacteria versus non-methane-producing?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it takes us right into the next section, which is, I mean, that the answer to that is constipation. And constipation, of course, can be caused by many things, so it's not to say that methane-producing archaea are the only cause of constipation, but methanogenic flora or archaea that produce methane are significantly associated with chronic constipation in the scientific literature. So the amount of methane produced is correlated with colonic transit time. So the more methane you have, the slower your transit time is. In one study, if a breath test was positive for methane, they saw a 100% association with constipation predominant IBS.
Wow.
So yeah, it's pretty strong in terms of association.
Yeah.
In other words, to put it in plain language, everyone who was positive for methane had constipation predominant IBS in that study. In contrast, the prevalence of methane was very low among patients with inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, which typically present with diarrhea. So you see that it's much more common in people with constipation than it is in people with diarrhea. I've also seen this correlation in my work with patients in people who have like the really chronic intractable constipation that doesn't tend to respond well to a lot of different interventions. I will often see really high baseline levels of methane and or an increase in methane production after the challenge test. A few other things you'll see clinically is methane producers can have a higher prevalence of rectal hypersensitivity compared to non-methane producing patients. So sometimes like pain in that area or just a feeling of urgency can signal methane production. This is not something that patients will be aware of, but if you're looking at test results in constipated patients, the average pH of the colon will be significantly lower in patients with methane-producing flora. So if you see a low pH on a stool test, that might be one potential sign of methane production. And it's also, I think the other thing that's important to know is that methane production, it seems to be much more common in women than it is in men. That's the only real demographic characteristic I've been able to find. It seems to be, you know, there's no age-specific distribution other than the fact that there is, you know, you don't get methane production until 3 years of age, as I mentioned before, and it will be lower in kids up to 10 years of age, typically. But other than that, the only significant association I found is that it's more common in women than it is in men.
And in your research, have you seen any associations between being breastfed or vaginal birth or C-section? Have you seen any associations around that?
No, I haven't. I don't think that means there isn't, but or there aren't any, but there's only a handful of studies on this topic. Most of them are pretty recent. Most of them were done by Dr. Mark Pimentel's group, and he, as many people know, has been a pioneer in research on SIBO and has a research clinic at Cedars-Sinai down in LA. It does a lot of great work. So I think there's still a lot to be learned about this. My guess is there is possibly an association, Jordan, but we don't really know for sure about that.
So Chris, before we move on, what do I do about this in general? If I'm somebody who I find with a practitioner that I have more of these methane gases in my body and I'm that type of a person with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, how does that change your approach as a practitioner and how does that change what I do as somebody who's trying to recover from this?
Yeah. So it could change the medications that you take for SIBO if you are going to take medications, and may change the way you treat it overall. So the first thing, taking even a step back before we get into that, is to determine, you know, so far we've been talking about associations between methane and constipation, but that doesn't necessarily tell us that methane is causing the constipation. It could be that constipation is causing the high methane levels. And there actually is some research to suggest that might be true. There are studies showing that treatment with laxatives and bowel cleansing like colonic can reduce or eliminate methane production in some patients. So that would suggest that constipation, at least to some extent, may increase the, you know, methanogens may favor a slow transit type of environment. And when you're constipated, you might get an increase in methane producing species. However, there are also a lot of other studies that suggest that methane directly causes the constipation in the first place. So for example, in animal models, they directly infuse methane into the small intestine. You see a reduction in transit time of 60% compared to just infusing normal room air. And they suspect right now that this effect has to be or may be mediated by serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, as I'm sure most people know, that is present in the gut in about 400-fold higher concentrations than it's present in the brain. So serotonin really, more than anything else, is a gut neurotransmitter, and it's thought to affect intestinal motility. So studies have found that methane producers have lower post-meal serotonin levels than people who produce primarily hydrogen. So I think it is pretty reasonable to assume that methane does play a causative role in constipation. And then there are also studies that show that the elimination of methane in treatment correlates very closely with symptom improvement. And that's where your question comes in, Jordan. So if you treat SIBO and you don't address the methane production, even if you get rid of the hydrogen, the patient is probably not going to improve to the extent that they should because you're not getting rid of the methane. So here's the tricky thing. Rifaximin, which is the drug that is typically used to treat SIBO, is not very effective against methane-producing species on its own. So, for example, in study with patients who all had baseline levels of methane above 3 parts per million, which established them as methane producers, 10 days of rifaximin alone led to a clinical response about 56% of the time, so roughly half the time. But it only led to a negative result on the breath test 28% of the time. So about 70% of the time, the rifaximin was not clearing the methane from the breath test. And in about half the time, it wasn't leading to any clinical improvement at all. Now, 10 days of another drug that's often used to treat SIBO on its own, called neomycin, led to a clinical improvement in 63% of cases, which is a little bit better than rifaximin on its own. And it led to a negative breath test result 33% of the time. So again, a little bit better than 28% for rifaximin, but not great, right? We're still talking about 2/3 of the time it's not working. But if you combine rifaximin with neomycin together, that led and take them for 10 days, that led to a clinical improvement 85% of the time and a negative breath test result 87% of the time. So now we're talking about some real treatment efficacy numbers here. So they don't really understand actually why the combo of rifaximin and neomycin works better than either of these two drugs alone. But there are other examples of where this happens, like the H. pylori treatment, right? You know, it requires two different antibiotics. And if you use one alone or the other alone, you don't get the same efficacy as if you use the two antibiotics together. So there is a precedent for this kind of thing happening. So the other thing to be aware of is that outside of rifaximin and neomycin, most methanogenic archaea are resistant to the majority of the antibiotics that are typically used against gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. So you're like cipros and flagels and things like that a lot of practitioners would use to clear out bacterial infection are probably not going to work for these types of archaea. And in my mind, this is another reason why botanical treatments can really make a lot of sense. We talked on a previous show about a study that showed that botanical treatments were as effective or more effective than antibiotics for SIBO and had far fewer side effects. And One of the reasons for this is that botanicals, herbs, plant substances have a really broad spectrum of activity, and it's far less likely that organisms will be able to develop resistance against a botanical, because within each single herb, there are many different active compounds instead of just one active compound with an antibiotic. So it's much harder for the organism to adapt to that. And typically, herbs or botanicals are used in formulas where you have many different herbs together. So you've got many different herbs, each of which with multiple compounds, and then they form together to create synergistic compounds, and it starts to become exponentially more diverse and complex and more difficult for organisms to develop resistance to. So I think given some of the research we have on the efficacy of botanical treatments, given the increasing problem of antibiotic resistance and possibly these archaea developing resistance to rifaximin and neomycin eventually, given the fact that studies show that about 1 out of 2 people who have SIBO and are treated successfully for it will relapse in the future, which is kind of a depressing statistic. I mean, not to get too far off on a tangent, but I bet a lot of people in those studies aren't doing low FODMAP, paleo type of diets, type of diet. You know, they're only just taking the drugs and then they're going back to eating the same crappy diet that led to the problem in the first place. So I think, you know, in my population, the relapse rates are not that high, but given all that stuff, it's possible that people will have to treat more than once is what I'm getting at. And I'm much more comfortable with the idea of someone doing multiple botanical protocols and using probiotics that secrete antimicrobial peptides, which are probably, you know, may work against methanogens, and food-based treatments like removing FODMAPs, which are the certain class of carbohydrates that feed the bacteria, which produce hydrogen, which feed the archaea. So if you starve the bacteria, you're reducing the hydrogen levels, and that in theory would reduce the levels of substrate that are available to the archaea to produce the methane. So the food-based treatment still works there. I did mention when we talked about the causal relationship with methane that some studies show that like a bowel lavage or a colonic or a laxative kind of thing can lower or even eliminate methane production. But I would be careful with that, because colonics, while they do wash out some of the bad gut flora, they also wash out a lot of good gut flora, and they're pretty invasive. And I think it's probably best to try to treat with herbs and diet and other antimicrobial nutrients than it is to use the like laxatives or colonics.
So one of the common objections that I always hear is, you know, if somebody's working with somebody like that follows Dr. Pimentel's work and they're very familiar with this type of thing, and they're going to end up on this kind of combo of neomycin and rifaximin, people like freeze, because we're all really afraid to use antibiotics now almost in this kind of health community, right? So One of the most common things I get asked is, what can I do before, during, and after this protocol to not totally set me back and destroy all my good gut flora?
Yeah, so it's a valid question. I mean, the good news is that rifaximin and neomycin are narrower in spectrum than like, you know, Cipro or some of the really broad spectrum antibiotics, and they're not going to wipe out your gut flora to the extent that some of those other antibiotics will. And they're not absorbed systemically. That's another advantage to those drugs. Rifaximin, I think, is like 99.8% stays in your gut and doesn't get absorbed. So it's not going to affect flora in other parts of your body as much. And so they are safer than a lot of other antibiotics. And my strategy is to start with the botanical protocols and use antimicrobial botanicals like olive leaf extract, Uva ursi, cat's claw, yerba mansa, coptis, artemisia, seda, etc. And then use soil-based organisms that secrete antimicrobial peptides, so Prescriptocyst, which I sell in my store. It's available in my store because I've just had such great success with it in just about everybody, which is rare with probiotics. You know, a lot of people don't respond to them very well. And then we have nutrients like lauricidin or lauric acid, which are antimicrobial, which may be helpful in these kinds of situations. So I like to start with a protocol with a whole bunch of natural things like that and see how they do. And I only really recommend rifaximin and neomycin combo if a couple of rounds of this initial protocol aren't successful. And then the patient I would definitely suggest they take things like Saccharomyces boulardii or other probiotics while they're doing the protocol and after the protocol. And then ironically, prebiotics are a big part of the healing process. And this is where it gets tricky because prebiotics are the fiber that feed the bacteria, which then produce hydrogen, which feed the archaea. So you have to make sure you reduce the levels of those bacteria and archaea first, and then come in with the prebiotics to rebuild a healthy gut flora that will make it less likely that you'll develop this problem again in the future. So it's a pretty, you know, involved process, and there's a lot to it, and it has to be timed right, but it's definitely possible and it works. It just takes more time in some cases than people expect. I mean, generally with SIBO, and especially if it's a recalcitrant case and the levels of methane are really high, I tend to tell patients this is going to be a 6 to 12 month process to fully deal with it. And that's what we're seeing in the clinic.
Well, Chris, I think we answered Seamus's question pretty in depth today.
All right. Yeah. So a great question. Keep them coming, everyone. It's really fun to hear your questions. Of course, we don't have a chance to answer them all, but we try to choose ones that we think will be of greatest interest to the greatest number of people and kind of spread out the topics. So keep them coming, and we'll see you next week.
If you want to get more info about what Chris is researching in between all these show recordings and all the studies that he's sharing, head over to facebook.com/ChrisKresser LAC and then also twitter.com/ChrisKresser. Thanks, everyone.